May it please the court, Mr. James Heidelberg will make the argument for petitioner. Petitioner is 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Jim Heidelberg. I'm from San Antonio. With me this morning is an associate in our office, Ms. Clayton Ferguson, who assisted in the preparation of this brief. The question before this court this morning is whether Rule 166AC, the summary judgment rule, particularly in its first sentence, means what it says. It is our position, based upon the action of the Court of Appeals, that there was an erroneous interpretation given to that particular provision. The rules of procedure are somewhat boring to many, particularly those in law school, as we heard before in the recounting of marital property rights at the University of Texas. Subject I did not enjoy, nor did I care to be reminded of it. The issue, though, in this case, is whether the trial court in Travis County, in entering a judgment based upon a motion which only asked for the granting of the motion based upon the pleadings, the brief that was filed with the motion, together with affidavits filed with the motion, should be granted. Cognizant of the fact that there had to be an exception, an objection to that motion that was filed in my response, which was filed with the trial court. It was my position then, and it is my position this morning, that the trial court and subsequently the Court of Appeals erred by not requiring the motion for summary judgment to contain the specific grounds for granting the motion. The underlying case involves a teacher in the Southside Independent School District in San Antonio who was a term contract employee entitled to certain rights if in fact his contract were not to be renewed for the upcoming school year, which turned out to be the case. He was duly notified. He made a proper request for hearing. A hearing was conducted. It lasted until 5:30 a.m. the following morning, which was commenced, I believe, at 7 o'clock the preceding evening. At approximately 3 o'clock, he made a request for a continuance, which was denied. And there was a contention made that, among other things, that was a deprivation of his rights to a fair and full hearing.
You mean at 3 a.m. during the course, he was at 3 o'clock previous afternoon?
No, sir. 3 a.m. the following morning.
While it was in the process of the hearing was ongoing?
Yes, sir. Prior to the twilight hours, and after several hours of testimony, there was a request made on his behalf for a continuance, which was denied. And there was argument and has been argument throughout the history of this case, which has been both in Travis County, in the federal courts and the state court, that there was not a proper objection made to the failure to grant that extension since he was not represented by counsel but rather by a layman. We don't think that argument has any merit, but that's not really the issue before this court this morning.
Mr. Heidelberg, if the motion and the brief had all been combined in one instrument, would there be any problem with that?
Your Honor, there would be with respect to some of the issues that were raised, noting your concurrence in the City of Mesquite Travis case that was decided last May. I believe some of those issues are present in this case. In other words, the trustees were sued in their official and individual capacities with one exception, and that trustee was sued in his official capacity only. But as to whether these trustees would have shared immunity in both their official and official and individual capacities was not raised in the motion or the brief, but only as to their immunity generically. In other words, there was a contention made in the motion, in the brief, in support of the motion for summary judgment, that the school board trustees enjoyed immunities conveyed by the education code upon employees of a school district.
Was the brief served with the motion?
Yes, sir, it was.
Was it attached?
Your Honor, I can't recall whether it was stapled together or not. It was, for purposes of this record, it was served contemporaneously with the filing of the motion.
And it was approximately 12 pages?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
A couple pages to the motion?
Yes, sir. That motion was filed in January. It was not set. As a consequence of that, I didn't file a response until it was set. And when it was set, I filed a timely response. I was concerned then, as I am now, as to the contents of the motion. I felt then, and I feel now, that the rule means what it says, that the rule has to be strictly construed as to the movement. And in doing so, the rules of pleadings and rules 45 and 47 of our rules also apply, and that if in fact a movement is going to ask for a severe sanction, and we know that in the current practice that sanction is being asked for more and more in our courts as well as certainly in the federal courts, that since that practice, I believe, is going to increase and not decrease, there needs to be an elaboration by this court as to whether in fact a motion must contain the stated reasons for granting the motion or whether it can be relied upon by a collateral document. There is some, the Court of Appeals relied exclusively on its interpretation of the Clear Creek case, the decision of Justice Spears in 1979. I believe relied upon erroneously. It's my position, Your Honors, that the Clear Creek case addressed the amendments that were made to the rule effective January 1, 1978, relating primarily to the duties and responsibilities of a non-movement in a case and not the responsibilities of a movement. The first sentence, which I read to the court in Rule 166AC, was not changed, was not altered. There was language raised in the amendment that was addressed by Justice Spears, wherein he pointed out that the practice of laying behind the log by a non-movement in summary judgment proceedings needed to be brought to a cease because what it was causing was to render the rule ineffective because summary judgments were being constantly reversed on appeal. I believe that that was the purpose and intent of the determination of this court in Clear Creek, and that the role of the non-movement was addressed by the rule revision and not the responsibilities of the movement. It would seem that the most efficient and pragmatic approach would be to simply elucidate a rule which would require a moving party in a summary judgment proceeding to set forth the reasons in the motion so there would be no question as to whether a brief that was supplied either contemporaneously with the filing or perhaps at the time of the hearing, which is quite common in our practice, at the time of the hearing, included or did not include a particular issue, whether a particular issue was tried by consent of the parties. There's no record made of most summary judgment proceedings. This court and other appellate courts would be asked, I believe, constantly to determine whether, in fact, an issue had been raised, and if it had been raised, whether there was trial by consent, whether there was a waiver by the non-movement, or whether there was not. I think that the clear way to eliminate the problems that are presented in this case and the problems that are presented in the summary judgment practice is to provide for a clear reading of the first sentence of the rule to mean what it says, and that is when you have a motion for summary judgment, you've got to state your reasons, and if you don't, then the opposing counsel does not have to be put in the position of trying to guess what the reasons are or to take the reasons out of an affidavit that may have been submitted in a summary judgment proceeding or a brief or other document, whether it's filed contemporaneously with the motion or perhaps at a later time, perhaps even after the court, I believe under the rules, has the authority to entertain additional matters after the hearing.
If the rule is it has to be in the motion, wouldn't it be prudent to not file a brief, put what you were going to put in the brief in the motion itself?
Exactly.
So if you had a 100-page motion, which was in essence a 2-page motion and a 98-page brief, that would solve this problem.
It would certainly solve this particular case's problem. Yes, Your Honor, it would. And it would put opposing counsel in the position of not having to make a logistic decision as to whether or not he or she is going to oppose a motion or whether he procedurally or whether he or she is going to make a procedural and substantive response to a motion that doesn't contain any reasons for the motion, which counsel was placed, that position I found myself in this particular case, of being in the position of trying to decide which horse I was going to ride. And perhaps I chose the wrong horse, but the one I did, I thought was grounded on the rule. Now, I know that this problem is of concern to the court, otherwise we would not be here this morning, but I truly believe that a simple elucidation of the rule, stating that it means what it says, will cause great comfort to those who are engaged in this practice in our courts.
Should the standard be fair notice, like our other pleading rules, or is there some overriding reason why the standard ought to be different?
Your Honor, I believe it should be fair notice if it's in the motion. And I understand the court's position with respect to the City of Mesquite case, but I do believe that that is going to cause a problem. And that problem will be that there's going to have to be a determination by an appellate court or this court, perhaps, as to whether or not there was fair notice in an ancillary collateral document. And I don't believe we need to do that. I believe we can eliminate the problem without having to do that. And the elimination of the problem would be to have the reason set forth in the motion as the rule states and requires. I have no further comment.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. John Fleming will present argument from respondents.
May it please the court, my name is John Fleming. I represent all the defendants in this case. And I believe Justice Heck has identified the issue, and that is this. Had I served this motion and left off the title of the third page, which begins brief and support, the entire document would be deemed a motion. And I wouldn't be here today, and goodness knows I wish I had done it that way now. But I think under either a fair notice standard or a strict compliance standard, we prevail because our motion stated, our two-page motion stated, the defendants respectfully request this court to enter a summary judgment based on the pleadings on file, this brief in support containing the undisputed facts as required by the local rules. So in our motion for summary judgment, we referred not only to the brief, but to the specific facts in the brief. And we did it this way, essentially, to avoid redundancy by repeating facts in the brief, or in the motion that were stated, I think, more logically, in the brief. So either under a strict compliance or a fair notice standard, we think we should prevail. Now, the important thing I think to realize is counsel for petitioner has nowhere said that he didn't know what the grounds were. He has nowhere stated in any of his pleadings that he was harmed. And we respectfully suggest that it would be improper for a court of appeals to reverse a judgment in the absence of some statement of harm if indeed Mr. McConnell was aware of the grounds on which the summary judgment was based. We believe the judgment of the trial court should be affirmed and the judgment of the court of appeals.
The motion for summary judgment itself did not contain the specific grounds, therefore, except by this cross-reference that you just given us.
That's correct, yes.
And we will often get in this court, I understand your particular brief was a fairly brief one, but we'll often get briefs that have appendices, law review articles, cases from other states, sometimes even separate volumes. Doesn't the rule that you're urging us to follow, rather than the rule that this court promulgated, one that invites people to kind of throw in the kitchen sink and everything else into their brief and hope there'll be something in there that they can eventually get summary judgment approved at some level?
We believe that the statement of grounds is what the court should look at. If the statement of grounds was contained at the beginning of the brief that was attached and is specifically referred to by the motion, we think that this court can avoid the problem of voluminous collateral documents being referred to as grounds in support of a summary judgment. I believe that the appellant, the petitioner here, has mischaracterized.
You're talking about the statement of grounds in the brief?
In the brief.
So what you believe we should interpret this rule to mean is that you look to the motion And if the motion cross-references the brief, you look at the beginning of the brief?
I believe if the motion cross-references the facts stated in the brief, that should be sufficient. That should be strict compliance with the rule. I think the Court of Appeals holding was much more narrow than the petitioner is telling this court. I'm not saying he's intentionally mischaracterized it, but in his point of error, number one, he says that the holding of the Court of Appeals is that a movement in a summary judgment motion can rely upon collateral documents. The Court of Appeals holding was much more narrow. It said, we hold that Rule 166A allows a summary judgment movement to set out the specific grounds for summary judgment in a brief served on all parties contemporaneously with the motion itself.
Would you repeat, please, the exact language in your motion cross-referencing the brief?
Yes. The defendants respectfully request this court to enter a summary judgment based on the pleadings on file, this brief in support containing the undisputed facts and conclusions of law as required by the local rules.
How about a cross-reference to anything that would support summary judgment in the attached deposition?
At that point, Your Honor, we have to argue fair notice. I don't think that that would be strict compliance with the rule. But so long as, unless the petitioner has stated how, what grounds he was unaware of, which he has not done before this court, unless he makes some showing of harm or unfairness or ambush, then the fair notice standard is complied with. So if there was a deposition attached and a non-movement appeared on the day of hearing and said, Your Honor, we have this voluminous box of depositions here. We don't know what the movement is talking about when he says, refers just to these depositions as grounds for the motion. I think it would have been improper in that case for the trial court to have rendered a summary judgment. But in this case, there's not a single specific ground that the petitioner claims he was unaware of. Indeed, a fair reading of his application for writ of error seems to all but concede that he knew the grounds were in the brief and had read them. And unless there are any questions, I have nothing further. I just request the Court of Appeals to approve it. This Court to affirm the Court of Appeals.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Very briefly, Your Honors. The problem that is created by counsel's approach is that you are, I believe, going to require the courts of appeals and perhaps this court to be making judgments as to whether there was fair notice or wasn't fair notice. There is just absolutely no reason why you can't require the rule to be interpreted literally, because it does use the term shall, and require that the motion contain the basis for granting for being granted and not being required to have the non-movement in a summary judgment proceeding, which is a summary disposition, which eliminates the right to trial by jury and does a lot of other things that the rules and our system of jurisprudence discourage. There's absolutely no reason why we can't set forth a rule which eliminates those problems. A court would have the opportunity, a trial court would have the opportunity to read depositions, to read affidavits, and to withhold this determination on the motion for summary judgment, as it did in this case, to make a review of documents unknown to counsel and render a ruling, as in this case, a generic ruling granting the motion for summary judgment without specifying the basis for granting the motion. And we would not know the basis upon which the motion was granted, and the non-movement would not have been apprised as to the true reason, the true concerns of the trial court, because they wouldn't have been articulated in argument, and they wouldn't have been articulated in a specific motion, but rather could be found in a document such as a deposition of the rules, or an affidavit, or some other collateral document.
Is it true that in this case you could tell from the brief what the grounds were?
Your Honor, it's certainly true that I could tell what some of the grounds were, and I'm not here to say I didn't. I'm here to say that what I did was to make a choice as an adversary to take a position which I believed at that time was right. And that was that if the motion was going to be filed and granted and there was going to be a summary disposition of that case, that needed to be done in accordance with the rules. Perhaps I was wrong. I have no further comments.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chairman. That concludes the arguments and the final call. The foregoing causes are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience is seated live. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.